It's music from Carolyn Ahrens. Hangs out in British Columbia, writes wonderful music, sings it beautifully. Very talented young lady, Carolyn Ahrens. Also writes for Christianity Today now and then. You'll see a post from her. Getting Ready for Glory, the name of the song. We heard from Chris Rice in Big Enough and from Laura Hawthorne, her brand new one called Without You. And good morning to you. It's 12 and a half minutes after the hour. And we're Broken Road Radio. Pleased to have you along today. David Punt is here with me, and I'm Jim Park. And joining us now from East Texas is Dr. Don Clark, who is a biochemist. He's with the Board of Creation Moments and just brings us a whole lot of interesting information and scientific opinion from a faith perspective, which you don't get very often, Dr. Don. This is really a treat.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you for having me on your program again this morning. Jim and Dave, we have an interesting discussion.
Well, global
this
warming.
This morning again.
Global warming. David has a new theory, though. Are we really going to talk about that, David?
we have a real
scientist here, and we're bringing up this stuff to him. I don't know.
Okay, this is David Wilson from Liverpool's John Moores University. He and his colleagues published results in the journal Current Biology. They figure that the entire population of dinosaurs, sauropods, brontosauruses, all the rest of them, produced 520 million tons of methane gas every year. And that has caused the Earth to warm, at least for that short period of time.
We're supposing that
you're waiting for the rest of it, aren't you? there is no more.
Well, I think if you combine that with the discovery of fire, we have an explanation right there.
Then previous studies suggest that it was that the Earth was warmer, 18 degrees Fahrenheit warmer during the Mesozoic period, and these researchers' answer to why.
Well, we might find out some interesting stuff here from Dr. Don on whether or not, you know, the warming and cooling cycles within the 6,000-year period, because I know you're a creationist, and creationists pretty well stick to a 6,000-year age of the Earth. And you can't have a whole lot of 10,000-year cycles in a 6,000-year-old, you know, universe. Now, British environmental expert James Lovelock is his name. Admits he was an alarmist about global warming. And this is an article you sent to me. What do you have to say about that? Is he a traitor to the cause here?
Well, I think the environmentalists would probably say he's a traitor.
Ooh.
And are not very very happy with him. But he's getting on in age. I read either on his website or somewhere else that he's about 92. Now, maybe wisdom is kicking in.
Or a deathbed conversion, maybe, too.
Well, I don't know about
wants
that.
To, wants to come clean here.
Yeah, exactly. Get the slate
guilty.
Clean.
Yeah, feeling guilt.
But, it's interesting that he was one of the fathers of this global warming, theory that
when did that all get started? When did that notion get started, and what sparked it? What kind of research was there to authenticate it?
Well, they were measuring. He, being kind of a NASA scientist, he wasn't working at any university or anything. He was a NASA scientist. He developed an instrument that you could measure gases at a very, very low level, at the, you know, nanogram levels, in the atmosphere. And so that allowed scientists and him to start measuring different types of gases, and one of the gases they focused on was CO2, carbon dioxide. And they found out that, it looks like over a period of, the short time that we've been measuring, CO2 has been increasing, and this could have a negative effect on our environment, in particular the temperature of the globe.
Well, if he was at NASA, this must have been, 60s, 70s, maybe early 80s when that happened?
Yeah, I think it was probably the 60s.
Okay.
It was the 60s. I remember all this going, taking place in the 70s and the 60s and 70s and the big hullabaloo. That was kind of competing with chlorofluorocarbons.
Yep, I remember that.
which, you know, of course, had another effect on our economy mm-hmm. from having to change out freon carbon 12, F12 from all of our refrigeration systems, especially in the automobiles. But that's another story for another time. But with the CO2, folks began to extrapolate, and so did he, that, gee, in 40 years, the Earth is going to be so warm that we're not going to, for the most part, we're not going to be able to live here. And the only people that are going to be able to live are those that are in, you know, very cold places right now.
So for 40 years, that would have been about now, or like within the next decade from the time they were making these prognostications.
Exactly. So here we are, 40 years later or so, and the Earth hasn't heated up that much. In matter of fact, you know, it's only been, I think, the stuff that I read, it's only been between 1.5 to maybe 1.9 degrees warmer than it was 100 years ago, and less than a degree warmer than the last, century. So,
but how much of a variation would be significant? When does it get to be significant? It was 2 degrees significant?
Well, I think that's a good question, too, because
I mean, that'd have to be guesswork. That'd have to be guesswork.
They were predicting 10 to 20 to 30 degrees warmer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would probably be significant.
It would.
We're nowhere, near those levels. And like I said, it's a little over a degree warmer than all of the recorded temperatures that they have in history, which doesn't go back that far. So we've got a couple of problems, and I think one of them, what is the motivation of these type of, not only calculations, but what's the motivation is there any political motivation behind any of these things? And, I think the real question in the global warming issue is man causing it?
Mm-hmm.
The Earth normally goes through cycles.
Well, if it's happening, is man causing it?
Exactly.
The real question.
I mean, that's
the
main question. I mean, if man's not causing it or doesn't have a very large contribution to anything that's happening with the climate, and Dr. Lovelock actually admitted this, that he didn't know what's going on. I mean, they don't know what's going on with the environment anymore, with the climate anymore.
In this recent article, he admits that he was an alarmist. That's in quotes, so I take that to be his word. And he says that Al Gore was as well. And I'm wondering what part of this might be ego. And I'm just kind of thinking back to Dr. Lovelock, and he has this new technology. He can measure gas, and so he uses it to develop a theory about what's happening in the atmosphere. And correct me if I'm wrong, this is just a layman's suspicion here, but if you develop a theory, you kind of get married to it. And you want to advance its interests, and you want to apply it to something significant and make a name for yourself. And if you have the power to persuade others to go along with you, you can start a whole movement, such as this one.
Right, exactly. And he did. I mean, he did. Mm-hmm. And so I think he was probably, I don't know how naive he was in anticipating that the world would really, grab onto this. He came out with this theory, did some calculations, said, oh my goodness, the Earth is really going to warm up. We've got to stop, producing this CO2. And so we got to stop burning things. We got to stop using gasoline in our vehicles and in diesel fuel in our trucks and everything. And we just have to stop. Or coal, for example, burning coal will give you CO2. Anything you burn is going to give you CO2. So the environmentalist picked up on that and said, well, gee, that's great. We can stop drilling, we can stop digging, we can we can save the Earth from the coal miners, and we won't pollute the waters with our drilling for oil. And this is great. But I think there is what really happened. There was a political aspect to it, whether he was aware of it or not. But the politicians picked up on it. And
that's a mystery to me, too. How did this get to be a partisan thing? I've never understood that. Why Republicans would tend to fall on, or conservatives would tend to fall on one side, and Democrats and liberals on the other. And I'm sure David has some thoughts on that, too. But why would they pick sides over this issue? It must relate to business and money somehow.
Well, industry
regulation, maybe.
I think it relates to the socialistic agenda. If you're trying to redistribute wealth, then this is a good topic for you to pick up on, because now you can tax the countries that are using the most energy. And at the time, it was the United States and Europe. And you can tax these countries, and then you can give the money to the poorer countries, and so you have a redistribution of wealth.
Well, and there's more to it than that, because if a government or a political party or some congregate or a corporate entity can create a sense of crisis, the power tends to move in one direction or another to someone who can solve that problem, and it would naturally flow to governments here. In other words, do something about this. We're threatened by this. Do something.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know. It's all, if you look at it from a political point of view, and I'm not a politician, obviously, but you would think that, okay, what party would this benefit the most, if we're trying to redistribute the wealth, if we're trying to solve this major global crisis. In our country, it happens to be the liberal, the Democrats, the mm-hmm. liberal side, because now we have an agenda that we can promote. And it's big bad industry that's causing this problem. Because we should have come up with other solutions than the trucking industry, for
greedy
example.
Greedy private sector, yeah.
Well, I remember it hasn't been that long when it was accepted as widespread fact. And it was, I remember, you know, similar leftist, liberalist thoughts and theories. And as soon as I say the word liberal, I'm reading a book that was written by a guy in the 20s, and back in those days, liberal meant self-sufficiency, and people were able to stand on their own, and freedom, and being able to do what you want to do in the marketplace, and all the rest of that. So even the notion of what it is to be a liberal has changed
kind of a moving
very
target,
very rapidly in the last 60 years. One of the things that after the global warming issue first came out, after Al Gore, released his movie, and he was given an Oscar for this movie, and then he was I think he was even given a Nobel Prize for this astounding work, that and everybody seemed to be on board with it. I remember as recent as 4 years ago that if I were standing up in front of a crowd and I would suggest that I want more information about global warming, I was almost ridden out of town on a rail. How could I possibly mouth such heresy and such ludicrousness that I would even think on my own? It was a very widespread belief and acceptance of the notion of these particular theories. And the other thing about politics is that sad to say, we would love to believe that our political leaders are elected on the basis of their wisdom and their intelligence and their knowledge, and they're not. They're elected on their basis to get votes, and that's the only reason. If you can find out where the parade is going and somehow get out in front of it, you're going to be a successful politician. I know that sounds rather cynical, but my experience has been that way. We've got a local politician around here who's, if you look at his legislation, it's all over the board. It has there is no central core philosophy that he follows from day to day to day, and he's been elected three times. His philosophy is, this is what I need to do to get elected.
Yeah, give them what they want.
And, you know, would you, and he's, his latest, or one of his latest bills would authorize spending $100,000 a year out of taxpayer money in the state to help old people and veterans go fishing. Hmm. Well, there's at least three charitable organizations that do that now. But he said, hey, look, these charitable organizations are having people follow them, and they're giving them money, and they're successful. I think I should have some of that.
The equivalent of wetting your index finger and holding it up in the air and seeing which way the wind is blowing.
Doctor, and I think global warming fits in really well with this, because now people are starting to question it, and it's more safe for politicians to say, "Hey, wait a minute."
Mm-hmm. And from political, it gets into faith matters. Is it because it came from the political realm? Is that where people started choosing sides in the faith community on this issue, or did that happen first? Is there? Maybe I should. Maybe
was,
I'm presuming
I it
something.
Was, you know, more. It got into the political realm for sure, and it went from science, which, you know, I'd like to talk more about, but it quickly went into the political realm. And in many of the churches where I was, where I've spoken or talked to people, conservative folks were really questioning the global warming things. So,
and this discussion sounds like a post-mortem on the global warming effort. Is it dying down now? has it reversed itself? Is thinking starting to move the other way?
Well, I mean, if you go to this Mother Earth conferences, which I don't go to, if you read anything from those conferences, you would say, "Wow, gee, you know, these folks aren't really in tune or want to be in tune with the latest science in this area." But I think here's what, from a scientific point of view, here's what happened with the global warming issue, and it also happened with chlorofluorohydrocarbons. You're taking some measurements over a number of years, and then you're trying to extrapolate out, 10s, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years out from that data.
Identify trends.
Yeah, you're trying to identify trends and say, okay, where is this going to go, 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now, or 50 years from now? And if you're really honest, the farther you go out, the noisier your data gets, until you get to a point where the noise is so great you can't even see a signal anymore.
That is, the less certain it gets.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And you have to assume that you've accounted for everything in your model that will help you to predict what's going to happen anyway. So here's what happened. One, I mean, the big hoopla over CO2 is ridiculous, because CO2 only contributes to the greenhouse effect, which is, you take a jar and you put a plant under it, and it creates its own little environment with moisture and everything. That greenhouse effect, CO2 only contributes 5%.
Mm-hmm.
Water, on the other hand, contributes a tremendous amount to the greenhouse effect. Now, water, however, has this self-stabilizing effect on our environment. That is, the warmer it is, the more moisture you have in the atmosphere. The more moisture you have in the atmosphere, that then tends to block the sun rays from coming hitting the earth, which then cools down the earth. And then on the opposite side, the cooler the earth, then the less moisture you have in the atmosphere, and the more sun can reach the earth, which then warms the earth back up again. So it's an interesting design, and those of us who believe in a creator God, mm-hmm. said, wow, just a simple molecule as water has such a tremendous regulating, automatic regulating effect on our environment.
Do I understand then you're saying that the water itself would more than compensate for any CO2 increase that we could generate?
Well,
it has much more leverage over what happens with the sun than does CO2.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then CO2 itself, the more CO2 there is in the atmosphere, the more the ocean absorbs CO2. And the more the ocean absorbs CO2, the more coral you have, the more aquatic growth you have, the more life you have, as well as on Earth. CO2 is a good thing for plants. They love it. The more CO2 you have, the happier they are, because they're, using it to produce sugars and everything, and giving us oxygen in return. So even there, we have a stabilizing effect, with the Earth and with the environment and how God created things, to help minimize all these things. And I think Dr. Lovelock finally recognized that this is much more complex than we thought.
Well, I get a kick out of some of the things he said. He wrote in 2006, apparently, in a British newspaper. He asserted that, quote, before this century is over, billions of us will die, and the few breeding pairs of people that survive will be in the Arctic, where the climate remains tolerable. But now he's changed his mind, and he's saying, and this is just in the span of 5 or 6 years here now. Now he says, the problem is we don't know what the climate is doing. We thought we knew 20 years ago. That led to some alarmist books, mine included, because it looked clear-cut. But it hasn't happened. So he's revisiting the evidence and saying, nah. But he's also the author of a book that says so. And that was the occasion for his interview on MSNBC when all this came into the news here recently. So I wonder what effect that has on his thinking, too. He must have changed his mind and written a book. But now he's out promoting that. So I suspect we'll hear more about this and more from Dr. Lovelock.
Yeah, well, I hope so.
Yeah.
And I hope he's honest about it, and I hope he doesn't say, well, one of the other comments that he made in that article was that, this is going to take a lot longer than I predicted.
Mm-hmm. He says,
so he's just delaying the problem. The problem still, what he's saying is the problem's still there, but it's just going to take a lot longer. And, folks, I'm just not going to live that long. So I'm going to just tell you that I made a mistake.
Yeah. And he says, quote, there's nothing much really happening yet. So it's kind of like closing the lab door and locking it, going to lunch for a while here. And we'll come back and see what's happening in the Petri dish. He's also apparently the author of a theory called, is it the Gaia theory of the Earth? What is that about? G-A-I-A.
Well, Gaia refers to Mother Earth. It's the goddess of Mother Earth. And so it's interesting. If you go back on his website, you can pick out very easily that he was an evolutionist and probably an atheist. Mm. I don't know what he is now, but at least his materials strongly suggest that. And the Gaia theory is that you can look at the Earth as an organism, and as such, it's a complex organism. And so if something happens over here on the Earth, it's going to affect something, maybe on the other side of the Earth or all over the Earth. So it's in the simplest terms, it's looking at the Earth as in the physical, physical realm. I'm not talking necessarily about biology, although biology is included. It's a very... it's a very complex organism. Hmm. Well, there is no such thing as Mother Earth. I do believe that God designed the Earth and designed the animals and the plants and the different type of plants that he designed and the different type of animals that he designed, that he had a purpose in everything, and things were in balance, and he designed things so that, okay, if we disrupt this balance, the Earth naturally comes back into balance if you left things alone.
Kind of self-correcting, yes.
Yes. So, I mean, take, for example, if you've been to Yellowstone, you know that, you know, several years ago there was tremendous fires that wiped out a lot of the forest at Yellowstone. You go back, you know, today, and the forest is rebuilding itself. And so, you know,
Mount St. Helens, another example of that.
Was at Mount St. Helens, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the trees, millions and millions of trees were wiped out on one side of the mountain. And, you know, the mountain's growing trees again, and wildlife is coming back into the area. And it doesn't take all that long. I mean, it's, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, and you've got another forest again.
You know, sometimes we talk about science, we keep telling ourselves, too, it's dangerous to generalize, but there's no monolithic science. There's no creature called science out there. This is made up of thousands or hundreds of thousands of scientists, each in their own career path and in their own theories and their own skills and aptitudes. And there's really very little consensus, is there not? And when there is consensus, is it in, and this is a whole different question, but it's on my mind now, is the consensus within the scientific community, or is it within the media community?
Well, I think in the popular issue, the media certainly has an influence on which voice in the scientific community gets heard. And it's the same thing, obviously, in the political realm. You know, which voice of the politicians are being, you know, heard. If it's a voice that they like, you know, if it's a voice that they like, they will promote it. If it's a voice that they don't like, they won't. They won't promote it. So they were scientists even back when Dr. Lovelock was, you know, promoting his Gaia theory and his global warming theory. There were scientists that were saying, well, wait a minute now, we just don't quite have enough data here. And I think, you know, people are being alarmed. There were scientists making that claim, but they just weren't being heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nobody heard about them. Yeah, and there's a... I would assume that in the scientific media world, or those people who write stories about scientific endeavors, there's probably the same kind of left-leaning progressive attitude about just about everything else they believe in. I mean, out of registered journalists who were registered to vote, 4 years ago, I think, something like 85 to 87% happen to be Democrat. And yeah, and that just that overwhelming proportion of people who ascribe to a certain belief, yeah, if that's the way you live, that's the way you believe all the time, sure, you would give more weight to those things that you already believe in. Kind of like, you know, well, he's not saying anything new. I already believe that. So he must be right.
Right. And even in the scientific community, as time has gone on, of course, there's been less objectivity, even in the scientific journals, because if you write a paper, if I were to write a paper, for example, on a subject and submitted it to a scientific journal, if the reviewers, who are other scientists, are all of the, you know, even not necessarily atheists, but if they're, you know, evolutionists, for example, my paper would not be accepted at all. Not because it's not good science, but just simply because the reviewers will, you know, try to poke holes in it. Which there's nothing wrong with that, but if they're not being honest with themselves and they have a tremendous bias, then you know, your paper just won't be published. So even now, as the scientific community has gotten more and more biased, there are folks who try to promote intelligent design. Not only can they not even reference anything about intelligent design, but if your article even suggests a designer, it won't be published and you will be blackballed.
You know, you'd think that objectivity is at the core of science. and it doesn't seem to be the case anymore. Is that a glittering generality?
I think that's accurate. It hasn't been, you know, it hasn't been the case for probably a number of years, as this battle really between creation and evolution. I mean, people say, well, the battle is, the scientists will say, at least on one side, the battle has already been won, and it's been won on the evolutionary side, and evolution is true, as we, you know, talked about many times on this program. Mm-hmm. And so there's no need to discuss it, and so anything that you might, you know, say, you know, I'm not going to even listen to you. As that has gotten progressively, you know, more advanced, and one of our governmental institutions was advancing that idea and really pushing it hard, and that's the American Academy of Science.
Ooh, yep.
So if you've got, you know, a an institution like that promoting a an idea, then you are extremely biased, and you, for whatever reasons, your agenda is, you know, you're pushing a certain type of agenda, and you're not allowing honest discussion on topics. And well, unfortunately, I'm afraid in certain areas that is definitely the case.
I think it boils down to fame, fortune, and self-esteem. And that ego plays a huge role. I don't mean just boasting or being proud, but believing that you're right is what's important.
Right. Well, and even in the scientific community, if you're a university professor, for example, and you are vying for grants, then if you have a popular, if you come up with a theory or are doing research in a popular area, you will be funded. And if you're doing research in an area that is not popular, you won't be funded. It's as simple as that.
How's the area of medical? Well, we could go on forever on this. One of the questions that Dave and I have brought up between us and discussed many times is when this slippery slope began in science, and I think, David, correct me if I'm wrong, but we tend to kind of focus in on like the 1880s, 1890s, when a lot of theology started going the wrong way, and when a lot of politics started going the wrong way, almost like there was a common cause, all headed in the same rather unsatisfactory and unsavory direction, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
I don't remember having that discussion with you, Jim.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Well, there's a lot of things you forget so easily.
Yeah, and you know, that's either a function of my advancing decrepitude, or we never had the discussion, one or the other.
Well,
I think those tendencies have been with us ever since there was a scientific journal or somebody that said, I says, I think we should maybe describe it this way. I've read stories about Darwin's, I was going to say progenitors, but you know, his contemporaries. I mean, the scientists who were doing scientific study in those days, and the backstabbing and the making sure this report got in this way and that way, and you know, and contacting people in the associations and the clubs and the groups to make sure that they thought or that they knew about certain procedures or certain discoveries coming down the pike. I mean, you know, those kinds of things have been going on for as long as we've been human beings. I don't think that's anything that's brand new. It's just now we have electronic media that gets it out much faster.
So you would say there was no tipping point, per se. This has been a long, gradual slide since the garden.
Yeah, I'd say that that's probably accurate. I don't think there's been a sudden, you know, descent into dishonesty. I think we've always been that way.
And I would probably say one of the, if there was a tipping point, the tipping point in, you know, many areas had to do with Darwin publishing his book, mm-hmm. The Origin of Species. And that getting, after a while, getting widely accepted, and then once it was accepted, at least in the area of creation and evolution.
Mm-hmm. Now, when was that, 1860s or prior, 1850s?
I don't know, I'm not sure of the exact date, okay. But it was in the mid-1800s.
Mid-19th century, okay.
Yeah, sometime. I think that had a major influence on this process. Now, the current scientific process that we have right now of being able to publish in journals and things like that, and having peer reviews, if you think of it, the more of your reviewers, let's say, who are bent in a certain direction because, okay, I don't believe there's a God. I don't believe, you know, so if there's not a God, then don't tell me anything that, you know, mm-hmm. is going to even point to a God, because I'm not going to allow you to publish it. I think that happened as kind of a result of Darwin's book, and more and more scientists latching on to that and saying, oh, yeah, that sounds reasonable. It's a naturalistic explanation of how we get there. I don't need to believe that there's a God anymore, and now I've got another explanation. As more and more of that penetrated the scientific, you know, community, then I think certainly there was a stronger and stronger bias. I mean, there was always, I think, a political element that was controlling the major institutions, especially in England. That then spilled over to the colonies and to the states once we got organized to be able to have our own institutions. But, you know, remember that in this country, our institutions, the educational systems was started by Christians. So the real question for the United States is, when did those institutions become atheistic?
Mm-hmm. As were hospitals, for example.
Right, exactly.
And care for the poor and the sick and the injured of Christian origins. And you got to figure this is part and parcel of the whole process of man making himself to be like God. Because
exactly,
in
right.
science, we create a new God.
we can become, if we, you know, as we've talked about before, we can become little gods. Mm-hmm. And that feels good.
Yeah, we're right. We know.
The 1859.
1859 was the book.
Yeah,
was it? Okay,
right.
Thank you.
And I would suggest, Don, that maybe it's even a little further back than that. At least the origin of the notion. I just finished listening to the book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. It's written by a Shakespeare scholar and a literary critic and theorist, Stephen Greenblatt. And he talks about an interpretation of a 2,000-year-old poem on the nature of things. And it was written probably about 100 years before Christ. And
by a Greek.
It was a Greek author, and it has resurfaced in writings and various and sundry things since. And it described this kind of notion that things evolve from other things, that they're not created. And that was written 2,000 years ago. So,
wow.
I think you're right as far as Darwin's publishing this radical notion, or supposedly radical notion that everything will just kind of evolve and take care of itself out of the normal systems that are in place, and that seemed to get a lot of publishing, a lot of notoriety. It seemed like a pretty easy thing to buy into. And you know, one of the things that I've heard or felt a long time about you leftist liberal thinking, and you know how we interpret it now, is a lazy way to approach things. And if you don't really challenge this stuff, it doesn't become tested, doesn't become the best it could be.
We're doing our best here, David, to challenge things, and I think Dr. Don has done that. And if we don't wrap this up, it's going to be Thursday very quickly here. So I'm sure, Don, you have lots to get on to. Thank you so much for bringing to the table what you have brought this morning. It was fascinating and mind enlarging, expanding, that's what we look to you for every Monday.
Well, thank you very much.
Dr. Don
thank
Clark.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you, Dave.
You're welcome.
Good talking to you, Don.
CreationMoments.com. I want to urge folks to pay a visit to that website till you find lots of more thinking like this. Faith-based, Bible-based, scriptural thinking on not only the creation of the universe, but the ramifications for all of us in the here and now. And it's creationmoments.com. You can link to it from our website, brokenroadradio.com, or just go there on your own. You will be rewarded amply, I'm sure. Dr. Don, thank you very much. Music from Buddy Green on a Broken Road Radio Monday morning. Good morning.